Okay, so we're going to do recommendation systems today, but before we get there, so this is, I guess, the last couple of points regarding feature selection, which we were discussing last time. So I don't know how many of you are pastafarians here, but if you are, you would know this particular graph, which shows, suppose you're trying to predict whether or not global warming is going to occur based on certain features, right? So here is a graph that shows an inverse correlation between the number of pirates and the global warming, okay? And it's a clean inverse correlation. As you can see, you know, as the number of pirates kept going down, the global warming, global temperatures kept increasing, okay? So in fact, if you are trying to figure out, you know, what is the, whether or not pirates, number of pirates is a good feature to predict global warming, the answer is yes, it is a good feature. The mutual information content is actually quite high. Okay, now correlation is not causation. Okay, so I guess the funny part of this might be that you are thinking, how can, you know, pirates actually cause global warming? In fact, if you need a causal theory, read the Flying Spaghetti Monster religion. They'll explain exactly, you know, how this is caused. But whether or not it is caused, you know, the correlation itself is quite useful in predicting, okay, whether or not a particular class occurs. Now, if you don't believe this, here is another one. Apparently, piracy has very strong connection to global warming. This one, if you do Google Trends to see whether people are searching for certain terms and how much frequency with which people are searching for certain terms, you notice that whenever they're looking for free movies, which is a sort of piracy, online piracy right now, that the time when they're looking for free movies, there is a dip in the global warming queries. So again, you know, this too is actually showing that piracy up, global warming down, so there is a direct inverse correlation. Once again, these are good things to keep in mind to see what actually you are computing when you are computing feature relevance. All you are looking for is whether the distribution of the feature is correlated with the distribution of the class. Is that correlation coincidental? Is this causal? That's a completely different question. Okay? Now, if you might think that these, you know, obviously these look as if nobody is really going to use number of pirates to predict global warming, okay? But here is something that I just read the other day in New York Times, that the best indicator, and the airlines are interested in figuring out, they always oversell the tickets on the flight, right? And then they're trying to see who is actually likely to show up, because if everybody shows up, then they have to bump people off. And bumping is costly because they have to give money to, you know, to bump you off the flight, right? So they're trying to actually figure out how many of the people who bought the tickets are definitely going to show up. If they are going to definitely show up, then, you know, you have to make sure that if the number of definite shows is already 100%, then you shouldn't be buying, selling any more tickets, okay? So in fact, so they are interested in mining indicators of passenger profile that tells us whether or not that passenger is likely to show up. And they found that the most, one of the best indicators that a passenger will show up to claim his or her seat is that the passenger has called in asking for special food, you know, like vegetarian meal or kosher meal and so on. So now you might think that, you know, being a vegetarian doesn't cause you to actually go on to flight. There is no causal connection. But there's a correlation. So you are pretty much sure, presumably, that you're going to take the flight. That's why it took the, you know, time of calling somebody and saying, you know, I want a special meal. Okay? Again, you know, much of what you do in feature selection, much of what you do in classification is not trying to compute a causal theory, but looking for correlation. Okay? And don't necessarily, we shouldn't necessarily confuse the causation with correlation. Unfortunately, as I said, in some cases, actually, you look, you know, in the reason this is funny for us is because we think we have a causal theory. We think we have a causal theory of global warming as to what actually causes global warming. But then we also thought, we had a causal theory of how, you know, planets revolve around Earth. Okay? So causal theories are, you know, when you make a theory from the data, you can never be completely sure. You know, you have to do enough experiments to make sure that, in fact, your causal theories are correct. Okay? Now, if you are, for example, given a whole bunch of data in some, you know, in microarray data, you know, which in biology, and the guys don't quite know which genes seem to be causing which particular kind of cancer anyway, and your machine learning algorithm or your feature selection algorithm says this particular thing seems to be well correlated with the disease, does that mean that the disease, that gene is actually causing it? No, it only gives you the experiments that you need to actually perform. Okay? So anyway, so that's something worth keeping in mind. It's interesting that separately from this, I mean, I made this slide, and then when I came in, one student came and asked me, is correlation and similarity the same? What would you say?
No.
They're not. Okay? Well, again, the point is, something is correlated to something else. Similarity means something is actually the same as this other thing. Okay? Okay. So anyway, that's for the feature selection business. And then we're going to talk about filtering and recommender systems. And then I started talking last time, and I said we are interested in personalization to recommend articles, to recommend items, to filter away some, unlike, you know, let's say if you have a news feed, you might want to remove the news articles and only present the ones that the particular user is likely to be interested in. That's filtering. Predicting, you know, based on your previous actions, what you are likely to do, what are you likely to buy, and so on. Okay, so this is sort of useful for keeping your customers happy. Now, traditional IR essentially has a single user working in single shot modes. In web scenarios, you have multiple users, all of them buying books or looking at results and so on, and you can actually work off of the similarity between users. That's something that you have available. Okay, because you have working continually part, that means users are actually interacting with a service more than once. Let's say you keep buying stuff from Amazon, so Amazon can actually get a profile of you. Because you are logged into Gmail, and forget that you are logged into Gmail, anytime you are searching anywhere in that browser, Google gets to remember what you are searching for, and so it gets to generate a profile on you. So the fact that your interaction is continual means you can actually profile the user, okay? And the fact that there are many users means you can actually do collaborative filtering. That means there are users similar to you who are buying these things, so you might also be interested. Okay. Anyway, so this is just saying that there are tons of recommender systems out there. One important question in recommender systems is, how do you actually get the feedback? So the idea in recommender systems is, people have done some transactions. Based on the transactions they have done, you would tell whether or not they are likely to be interested in certain books or certain other items. Okay? So the question is, when do you know beforehand? I mean, first, for that you need training data. What's your training data? You know, how do you know that the user is interested in some books? Okay? So for example, non-intrusive ways of getting the feedback is they have clicked at certain pages and looked at them for longer time. That means they are interested in that page. They read some click pages longer than some other click pages. They saved or printed certain click pages. They followed links in the pages. They bought the items. If it's an item recommendation service, they bought the item, or they put it in Amazon scenario, you can put it in the wish list. Okay, apparently, I mean, I don't know how many of you ever got anybody buy stuff for you from your wish list. I've been putting a lot of things, and none of them, you know, seem to be bought, other than myself. But anyway, so if you put it in the wish list, it should at least show that you're delusional and you have friends who keep looking at your wish list and buy your stuff. But, you know, presumably you are interested in getting a copy of that, okay? And then you try to put it in the shopping cart, which means many a time, actually, at least you wanted to see what is the price that Amazon is trying to sell it for, because until you put it in the shopping cart, they won't tell you the price for some of the things, okay? Either of the, all of these are non-intrusive ways of just figuring out that when the user does this action, you can think of that as the showing user's interest in that. Okay. A more intrusive is ask users to rate items and pages. In particular, for example, Netflix, right? Just because you rented a movie doesn't necessarily mean that you're interested in it, especially for the case of Netflix, right? Because how many of you know Netflix service? Okay, so no wonder you're not having any time for this course. So basically, you already paid for $17 or something, so you have to keep on getting these movies, and so whether or not you like it, you just get the movies, and only after you see them, you will actually figure out whether you like them or not. Okay? So if you do like them, then you get a chance to actually rate the movie. And so in the case of Netflix, in fact, one of the biggest points is that they have this ton of this user-supplied ratings on the movies. And, I sent you a mail, and I think many of you probably are aware of the Netflix Prize, which was essentially, when it first started, it did not have any recommendation system, but then it realized that, the only way they can keep users, renewing after they see the first six or seven movies that they always wanted to see, to keep them renewing their membership, they need to keep sending them movies that they are interested in. Now the question is, which movies, there's so many movies that you may not even know that there are certain movies that you might like, and so somebody has to recommend them to you. And so Netflix got into the habit of recommending movies to you. And the more the recommendations of Netflix are actually, relevant to you, the more you're going to see more of those movies. And so that would be a good thing for them. And so they put a lot of time and effort into actually doing recommendations, and then they put this prize trying to, challenging people to increase the accuracy of recommendation from, I don't remember exactly, from like 94% to 95% or something like that, So it was already pretty high, 87% accuracy they had before, but then they needed higher accuracy, and so they made this. And so, of course, the story of Netflix prize is the first version actually was fine, and I think some AT&T guys won, and I sent you a mail after last class. About that was actually a snapshot of the first version of the prize before the prize was awarded. And you guys know what happened to the second prize, right? The second version. So this is what happens to computer scientists, right? Because we are always complaining in this area, especially of recommender systems, the thing that you really need is the data. Okay, the reason Netflix can do well is because it has this tons and tons of real data that are people actually labeling the movies. Okay, and so one of the things that was actually helpful from a research point of view in Netflix Prize is that they made this data available freely to anybody, so that, they anonymized it so that people's names can't be seen, but they made this data available freely and then actually asked people to, improve the prediction accuracy. Now, what happened for those of you who haven't followed the news in about 2 months back or a month back, now, unfortunately, if you make data available freely to people in 494, which is information retrieval and recommendation systems, you unfortunately also make it available to people in Galen June's class, who is the security guy. And their interest is to show that any data that is available can be, de-anonymized. So this guy, in Austin, essentially, he and his advisor essentially broke through the data and was able to identify the user number 7855975, they were able to figure out where this user lives, what their name is, what their height is. That is de-anonymization of the data. And thanks a lot to them, now, Netflix canceled the prize and also took away the data. Okay, and this is not the first time this happened. In fact, many years back, AOL, how many of you even know that AOL exists? So America Online essentially made the same thing. It made available search logs of people searching for things, okay? Because in America Online, you would be already logged in, okay? And so they could see which user was looking for what, and so they, some researcher in the AOL labs essentially thought they anonymized it well enough, so they anonymized the data and gave it out so that people can actually do a lot of research on, for example, how can you do more relevant search results, based on the previous information about what people have searched, for example. Remember, this was pre-Gmail era where you could not get people to be logged in when they are searching. So if every time you search in separately, then I don't have a large enough collection of your profile. Whereas in AOL, you are a user, you will be just logged in, so you can actually, they can actually track you. Okay, and so somebody else de-anonymized that data, and that set us back, you know, several years, because nobody else ever wanted to give out data until Netflix got the courage to say, okay, we anonymized the data stronger than the AOL bozos, and they gave it out. And then sure enough, this guy in Austin now is going to Stanford as a faculty member, you know, and so if you ever see him, you can thank him for setting back recommendation systems research another 10 years. But anyway, the interesting point is that the data for Netflix was actually very carefully, painstakingly collected, because real users actually provide the ratings for the data. This is something that we'll talk about a lot. In general, getting ratings isn't easy. People aren't going to just sit down and rate, items, okay? So part of the issue is, given the sparsity of the rated items, how can you somehow still act as if you have large enough training data? This is something that we will have to deal with. We'll talk about some approaches which sort of generate pseudo ratings, okay? So just so that you can then do recommendations. You know, and it won't be unlike pseudo-relevance feedback, which we talked about. What was pseudo-relevance feedback? Pseudo-relevance feedback is the one where we assumed that the top 10 results that the search engine came up with are also the results that the user is interested in already. So you assume that the top 10 are relevant, and so you add up those vectors. And then basically do alpha times that, add that to the query. So without actually asking the user, do you like this information? Okay? Anyway, so this issue of how to get feedback is a big issue, and you know, currently these are some of the ways you do it. One other interesting question about recommendation, I brought this up here because for the rest of the lecture, I would just assume that the feedback has been provided. And we just have to talk about how to exploit it. But when you are trying to do recommendations, your biggest problem would be, how do you get training data? Okay, the second one is, if you actually figured out a great recommendation for a customer, okay, the question is, how do you justify it to them? Okay, I mean, you can ask yourself, if somebody just, you know, calls you up, you know, anonymously and says, go see this movie, are you just going to stop doing whatever you're doing and go see that movie? No. You need to be given some explanation as to why this person thinks you would like this movie. Okay, now explanations, and similarly, if Amazon says, you know, I think you will be interested in this book. I mean, how dare Amazon think I would be interested in a certain book? You know, what do you think is the reason? So then they have to come up with an explanation and a justification. Now, justification can be bogus, but it should be there. Okay, now the problem is, we will look at two different ways of recommending. One is content-based, I mentioned it last time. Content-based, the other is collaborative. Content-based recommendation systems are actually better suited for providing justification. At least they can say, here are all the features in this book. You know, the following words occur in this book. And you seem to have bought books which have these words. And so I thought you would be interested in this. And that might make sense to you. Okay, collaborative filtering, on the other hand, is a harder issue. If you got, you know, recommended a book because people like you seem to be liking this book. Now, normally you would want to know, who are these people who are like me, right? And then they have to say, oh, customer number 785985 and customer number 978599 are your soulmates. We have decided this because soulmates are, remember I told you, soulmates are ones that you don't know exist, and you just, you know, somebody else decided based on your, you know, buying habits. And those soulmates have this extra LP, which you don't have. And LP, by the way, is long playing record. So CD, or, you know, bootlegged MP3, whichever you like. And then you too might want it. Now, that doesn't look like a particularly good justification. You know, I mean, show me these soulmates. You know, I'd like to see a photograph, for example. You know, that's an interesting question as to how do you convince people that this is a good justification. And you know that humans don't take just random orders, right? I mean, they would like to think that there should be some rationale behind anything that they're being asked to do. Okay, so this is something you have to think about, how to get justification. Okay, so there are two ways, two generally, you know, distinct ways of doing recommendation. One is content-based, one is collaborative filtering. Content-based essentially is just a, you have, you know, features of the books or the items that people have bought, and for each of the ones they bought, you know that those are positive examples. The ones that they didn't buy, they're all the negative examples. Okay? In particular, actually, in fact, the question about negative examples, this is also an interesting issue. In doing non-intrusive, right, the books that you bought are your positive examples. Fine. What about negative examples? How do I know what books you don't like? Can I just assume that everything that you have not bought is a negative example? If it is, then I have nothing to recommend to you. Right? Because the ones you didn't buy, you are not interested in it. So how can I tell you that you should be interested in this? Getting negative examples is also a tricky issue. In fact, you know, for example, you bought the book and returned it. That's a good way of showing it's a negative example. Okay? In general, you know, or if you rated the book, you bought the book and then you gave it a one-star rating. Now on Amazon, you currently now see one of the user reviews, they will say certified to be a buyer of this item. I don't know how many of you spend their life on Amazon, but I do. And so for the reviews, they'll actually say this guy might be giving a one-star review. Now the question is this guy actually ever bought this item and used it? No, because we don't know who these people are. So Amazon knows who these people are, and so what it will do is, if it is a person who actually bought this item from Amazon, then they would put a little flag saying, this person did buy this item. Now, he may still have made up this review, but at least you know that they actually have some reason to have used that item. Okay? So that's another way you get the negative review. So in fact, people have to explicitly say they didn't like something before you can assume they don't like it. Okay? Now, if you have everything just positive, now other issue, of course, is other idea is to assume all training data is just positive examples. Then what happens? Yeah, if all training data is only positive examples, there are very few, you know, there are learning algorithms which are suited to, you know, cases where training data only includes positive examples and no negative examples. Okay? But there are also many learning algorithms which will just flounder if, in fact, there are no negative examples. Because negative examples stop the learner from overgeneralizing. Right? The assumption is that when you have positives and negatives, you want to come up with the most general description of these positive examples that doesn't also include the negative examples. That's basically what learners try to do. And if you are not careful, then essentially just a positive example-based learner can essentially say, they like everything. Because everything I start till now, they seem to be liking it, so they like everything. Okay? In fact, since we said this, it's an interesting point that for those of you who are parents in the class or who have parents, which I think all of you do, you might know that human learning mostly, for kids apparently, mostly occurs from positive examples, not from negative examples. Although you can't tell this to parents, because parents are always, I mean, including myself, saying, don't do that, don't do that, don't do that. And that's all just completely ignored by kids, supposedly. And they mostly only learn from the positive examples. So positive example-based learning is possible, but not all algorithms are well-suited for that. Okay? Okay. So we have content-based and we have collaborative. And this content-based learning recommendation is really nothing but just classification learning. Okay? You can do lots of systems, and let me actually give one, you know, you could just say I would have my items represented in some attribute space, you know, attributes and their values, and then, you know, use whatever classifier I like. Now, of course, if it is text data, I said knife-based classifier is a good one, which we spent time, you know, talking about. Here is a slight variation of the knife-based classifier, which is actually useful for text data with structure. Structured text data. The idea is that, let's say if you have an Amazon book, right, then you have the title of the book, you have the authors of the book, there is a review field for the book, okay, and a word occurring in each of these fields is a different occurrence. Previously, we would just say, did the word occur in the file? Right, that's what we looked at in the last class. Unigram model looks at whether a word occurs in the file and how many times does it occur, in how many positions does it occur. Now, in fact, you could think of Amazon books as a vector of bags, right? Where each bag, so title is a bag of words, author is a bag of words, review is a bag of words. Okay, synopsis is a bag of words, but each of them is different bags. So a word occurring in one field has different meaning than the same word occurring in a different field. So what you would do is you would look for a slight generalization of Naive-Bayes classification, where in trying to again compute what is the probability. Given a book, what's the probability that that book belongs to a particular class of, let's say, relevant books for this user, the book that the user would be interested in buying? You would compute this not just in terms of the Bayes rule, right, which is prior probability of the class and the probability of the book, probability of the book itself occurs in the denominator. And this part, you essentially differentiate, you assume that the book itself is made up of these K bags. Each bag is a file, okay? And then you compute essentially the probability of a word occurring, given that it's a class CJ and you are in the title field, what's the probability that that word occurs there? Okay? So for now, the number of probabilities you would compute would be multiplied by the number of bags. Previously it used to be number of classes times number of words. Now you multiply it by the number of bags. You get more, you have to assess more probabilities, but then that will be able to differentiate between the same word occurring in one bag versus another bag, occurring in title versus review versus synopsis. Okay? So for example, the word trash occurring in the title of a book might mean completely different than it occurring in the word review, right? Trash could just be the part of the title. Okay, so that's something that you can handle, and it's a very straightforward extension of NBC, a Naive-Bayes classifier. And now, once you do this, when you compute these, remember these probabilities are computed from the training data, which is for each book that the user did buy. Are not by, these probabilities. You know the description of the book, okay, in terms of its bags, okay? And then each bag, how many of the books that were bought by the user had the word trash in the title field. That's what this particular probability might be assessing, okay? And then once you assess the probabilities, the user profile is just these probabilities. Okay, because next time when a new book comes, you essentially decide whether that book would be interesting to the user or not by plugging in these probabilities into this equation and seeing whether it's above a certain threshold. Okay, in particular, in fact, CJ is, let's say, the user would be interested, not CJ, the user won't be interested in this book. And so if you get both those probabilities, right, if one of them is much bigger than the other, they should add up to one, of course. If one is 0.49, one is 0.51, that means you really don't quite know whether the user likes it. Okay? If one is 0.1, the other is 0.9, that means you are pretty sure. Okay? So that idea of probability of CJ given book by probability of not CJ given book, this is called the odds ratio. Right? And notice that these two numbers have to add up to one. CJ and not CJ given book had to add up to one. The question is, how are you splitting one? Okay, if it is 0.5 by 0.5, odds ratio would be one. Okay, whereas if it is 0.9 by 0.1, odds ratio would be 9. And the bigger the odds ratio, the more likely, more confident that the user would like it. Okay. The other thing is that you can, if you want to actually just describe this user based on, when I say a profile of a user, in essence, I'm sort of acting as if somebody asks me, can you give me something that I can understand about this user, I'll give a little description of the user. Right? So the question is, if I have these probabilities, can I provide a description of the user? Well, yes. Because the ones, what I can actually look for are words that are most indicative of the user's preferences. Okay, and just list those words and say this is the profile of the user, and then I can sort of understand. So for example, you saw this, nowadays you see everywhere this cloud of words, right? Cloud of tags. How many of you have seen clouds of tags? Some words are in big font, some are in small font. The big font ones are somehow they're more frequent in all these articles. The small font ones are less frequent. So one idea of actually deciding the profile of the user is look at all the words. Basically give, the question of course is which words become bigger, right? I give the list of the words that seem to be discriminative for the user. In the sense, those words appearing in various fields will change the user's interest in buying or not buying the book. Okay, and the most relevant words, for example, are consider probability of the word given that the book is relevant. That means how likely is that word to occur in the books that the user is buying, and how likely is the word to occur in the books that the user is not buying. If both are equally probable, that means it's a non-discriminative word. Right? For example, the word the, hopefully, would have same probability in both classes. Whereas if it's much higher probability in the relevant class than an irrelevant class, or vice versa, then it is a very descriptive term for the user. So here is a cute little thing where you can just take, this is sort of log of these two probabilities, and then whichever have those high values, those words essentially can be shown in big letters, big font. Okay, and that sort of describes the user, if you're interested in giving the profile of the user. Okay, so this is all about, and obviously what I'm doing here is connected to the mutual information. So the idea is, if this word is independently distributed in the books, irrespective of whether or not they're relevant versus irrelevant, then this value is going to be 1, and log of 1 would be 0. If not, it will be higher. Okay? So the other question is, this is basically, this slide is just a repetition of content-based filtering, classification stuff as applied to content-based filtering. And here you learned at least the idea of extending naive-based classifier to vector of bags model, which is actually a very useful thing to do. Now, by the way, this idea of vector of bags is also our introduction to something that we'll get into for the rest of the semester, which is exploiting structure. The reason, there were vector of bags is because Amazon carefully separated the title from the author, from the reviewer. Okay? And if we look at, if you just give a bag of words model of the entire file, or just the normal text of the entire file, then it won't be obvious to an IR system that these are occurring in different, semantically different pieces of the file. Okay, so what we are doing here is actually by doing vector of bags model, we extended naive-based classification to exploit structure. Okay. In this particular case, Amazon already gave you the structure. In another case, you might want to first extract the structure. So you just have like a synopsis of the book in front of you, which has the title, the author name, the price, and the synopsis, and the New York Times review of the book. And you look at that file, and you have to separate them into the five bags first. Once you do that, you can use this. And the reason you would want to actually get those bags out is because you have to convince yourself that you could have done the classification here either using this more complicated naive-Bayes classifier, which actually assumes that occurrence in different bags signifies different things, or you could have just said, just class CJ. So ignore the, probability, ignore the bag information, and assume that the probability of the word given the class, the word occurring anywhere in the file given the class. The reason this should be interesting is because the accuracy with this has to be better. I'm not able to show this to you just by saying this, but the empirical studies show that you can more accurately predict whether or not a user would be interested in buying the book if you actually did this vector of bags model rather than just one single bag model. Intuitively, it makes sense, but it's also true actually in practice. So that also shows why you should exploit the structure and extract it if needed. Okay, but that's for next week. Today, the rest of the class, we'll talk about collaborative filtering, the idea here is sort of you ignore what is in the items that are being bought. You're only interested in who is buying the items. Okay, so for this discussion, let's assume that user is like a document. Okay, and the items are the words. So remember, document was bag of words, and a purely materialistic view of human beings is that they're a bag of possessions. Okay, the bigger your bag, the more of a human being you are, I guess. Anyway, so users are bag of items that they have bought, and of course it's a bag, so they can have 9 video cameras and 15, flip camcorders and just one copy of a computer science textbook, for example. Okay, so all of these are the things that they have bought. For each of the item, how many, what item? So in this particular case, you could either think of the number of times they bought the item, or in fact, here I'll just assume for each item, what is their rating for the item? Okay, in this case, A, they liked 9 out of 10, B, they gave it a rating of 3 out of 10, Z, they gave it a rating of 5 out of 10, let's say. Okay, and then basically what I have is I have another user to whom I'm trying to recommend, and my question is, so they have rated A and B, they presumably bought A and B, they have rated those. These other things in between, Z also was rated, there were a bunch of things that they did not rate. Presumably that's because they haven't yet bought them. Okay, and you might want to suggest to them whether they would be interested in buying them. Okay, and whether or not they would be interested in buying them depends on what their implicit rating would have been had they bought it and rated it, right? So you are trying to fill in these blanks. Okay, now to do this, one way you do it essentially is you are going to take this bag corresponding to the active user compared to the bags of the existing users in the database, find k closest matches. Which bags are most correlated? Okay, most closely matched, and having computed that correlation, and you computed the k similar neighbors, then what you would do? Let's say in this particular case, these two are closest to them because A9 B3 Z5 A10 B4 and Z1, right? So of the ones that they seem to rate, they seem to reasonably agree. Okay, now the question would be, then you would say, when you agree with the user on the items that you commonly that are common between you, that means you rated them together and you seem to agree when you do that, then the question is, these guys, for example, this guy already rated C has been rated as 8. This guy hasn't yet rated C. So you would like to essentially say, this guy, if he were to rate C, would have given it a rating of 8, which means it's worth recommending C to this guy. That's the basic idea. Okay? Now the question, of course, is how do you make this happen? How do you actually find users that are close to the active user? Okay? Now you could start, by the way, believe it or not, you can start with essentially think of this just simple. These are bags, you can think of them as bags and do bag similarity, cosine theta metric. Okay, if they are ratings, then you can actually see that what is probably more important, in particular in the case of ratings, one of the issues is, you know, this is something that if you read that New York Times article I sent you yesterday, you would notice that some people are hard to please. You know, even if you give them a scale of 1 to 1,000, they will only rate everything between 1 to 5 because they're really, really hard to please. Okay? And some are extremely easy to please. So anything, you know, even if you give them a scale of 1 to 1,000, they mostly rate it from 995 to 1,000. Okay? What matters really is, you know, a normalized rating and the correlation. So the question is, for each user, you might want to look at what is their average rating. And then if a particular item's rating is above their own average, that means they actually like it more. If it's below their own average, that means they like it less. And for a new user too, you would say if it is above, this particular item was also rated above their average, then they both are correlated. Okay? And the degree of correlation is, of course, how far above the average both of them are. Okay? So if you take that into account in deciding which of these guys are closest to this, you would be actually defining similarity in terms of the correlation. Defining the similar users in terms of the correlation. Okay? So, you know, this is just saying that you can think of them, you know, the data you have as item user matrix, obviously, and then you can do vector similarity, you can do scalar clusters, all those things that we talked about, you can do them. There is actually, they're not zero value ideas, okay? It's just that correlation might make more sense if, in fact, the data you have is rating, okay? If in fact, instead of actual rating, you went into people's houses, and then just actually looked at how many books they have, okay, of this particular, how many copies of this book, this particular item they have, let's say, and then so you really did get the bag of their possessions, then you would actually be better off comparing bags in cosine theta similarity matrix. Okay, because then the number of the copies that you have of something might mean, for example, if I have huge number of tomatoes in my home, then I'm like one of these cat lady in The Simpsons, and I have like a huge number of cats in my home, then you should be able to see that this guy has something for cats. Okay, and then somebody else also has huge number of cats, then clearly cosine theta similarity between these two people is low, is high rather, so that means they're similar. Okay. And different weighting is that I don't even actually go into their homes. I ask each of them to rate how much do you like cats in a scale of 0 to 10. Okay? And if both of us rated approximately the same above their averages, then we are again correlated. Okay? So the point I'm making is we will focus on correlation, but the bag of similarity metrics are not that far off the mark. Okay? Okay, so one collaborative filtering method that we'll talk about specifically, which is this basically k-nearest neighbor method, where, as I said, you get, you know, weight all the users with respect to the similarity to the active user. Just get, you know, k users and consider how similar they are to the user. Okay, and then of those k users, they look at the normalized ratings they have for any of the items that the active user has not yet rated. Okay, and then take the weighted average of those ratings and predict it as this user's rating. And the weighted average, of course, the weighted average comes from, I am, you know, 1.0 similar to this user, okay, and this user rated it above average for them. I am 0.4 similar to this user. This user rated it below average for them, and so I have to combine those two ratings into my rating. That's the weighted average. Okay. Now, in talking about the similarity, as I said, we look at correlation, and the correlation is you take the covariance of the two ratings, and first of all, you would consider, so covariance of the two ratings, vector, rating vector for A and rating vector for B, and then A and U in this case, and then you divide that by the variances of the individual ratings. And if you do this, you kind of get a normalization. So this is called Pearson correlation coefficient, and this is sort of has this flavor of taking care of people who give big numbers versus people who give small numbers. And people who tend to, you know, put all their likes and dislikes in a narrow area versus people who will put it over a much larger area in the ratings matrix. Okay? That is taken care of by not only taking the covariance between the ratings, but dividing them by the variance of the individual ratings themselves. Okay. Now both covariance and variance are defined this way. In the case of covariance, for each item, you consider the A user's rating minus A user's average rating over all items. This way you kind of tell whether it's really above average or below average, and what matters is how much above or below average it is. Okay? And multiply that by for the B user. Okay? And this is covariance because if both of them are essentially above average, they will, you know, positive times positive. If one is above, one is below, then positive times negative. Right? And so if they are correlated, that means you will get this summation to be bigger. If they are kind of negatively correlated, then you will get it lower. Okay? And then of course you divide it by the number of items, M. Okay? That's the covariance. Now the variance is defined the same way, except variance is covariance with respect to yourself. So both A and B user is yourself. Okay? And the advantage, really what you're interested in is this. The reason you're dividing it by this is to take into account. This is like in the cosine theta similarity metric, what is this? What is the equivalent for cosine theta similarity metric here? Normalization. Exactly. So remember, we used to divide everything by the size of the vector. That's what you're doing here. Okay? So this is not hard to do, right? You have the ratings and you can compute this. You have a calculator, you can compute this. Okay, so once you do this, you get the Pearson correlation coefficient. The more positive it is, right, the better off you are. The more negative it is, the worse off you are. Okay, zero means it's uncorrelated. Actually, negative is good because it's negatively correlated. Zero means this user doesn't tell you anything about whether or not you should like a particular item. Because your ratings and their ratings are essentially independent. Okay? Fine. So now neighbor selection, given the active user, select a correlated users to, so the idea is just take the k most common, k users which have the highest correlation. And then, or you could say, you know, just put a threshold and say any user whose Pearson correlation coefficient is above this value would be considered, either which way. Okay. Once you do that, the next question is ratings prediction. Now I know which are the users who I'm going to go with. Okay. Theoretically, notice that in fact you don't need to pick k users. If in fact your correlation computation is flawless, then you can bring in everybody. The reason you focus on k users is for efficiency reasons. It's the same thing in the k nearest neighbor. You know, you look for just k neighbors around you and see their majority label and say that's my label too. Okay. So anyway, once you pick the neighbors who you think are your soulmates, k soulmates, then you want to decide what your rating would be based on their ratings. And for that, again, this idea is simple. You start with your average of the ratings. If you don't know anything else, your assumption is that you would have given it the rating which is equal to the average of all your ratings. If you are one of these guys whose ratings are all between 995 to 1000 until now, your average rating is something like 997. Okay? And if you are one of the guys whose average rating is, you know, all the ratings are between 0 and 5, then your average rating is 2.5. And then the question is, what's the delta that you're going to add to make it above the average versus below the average? And the delta you're going to add is for each of your neighbors, you take the delta they have, variance they have for that particular item from their average. Okay, so for example, you're looking for the ith item, you look at this user's rating for ith item minus this user's average rating. This tells you whether they like it or dislike it and by what degree. Okay, now multiply it by the weight you have for that user, which is the similarity you think you have for that user. And then so it's a kind of a convex combination. And then you actually, so you multiply it by these weights and you divide it by the sum of the weights. Okay, if you do this, you will get a number which tells you approximately how far away from average you should be for this. Okay, that's it. That's collaborative filtering. Which? No, this is, so all I'm saying is that you, the user U for ith item, let's say, has given rating 7. User U is one of the k neighbors you selected. They have given a rating 7. Their average rating over all items is 5. 7 minus 5 is plus 2. So they tend to go plus 2 above their average. But you are close to this guy with this much weight overall. You're close to this guy with this much weight overall. And so you kind of, rather than just go with this user, if this is the only user, then that you consider this to be, if k neighbors, k equal to 1, and this is the only neighbor you trust, then you just go with, you know, the weight doesn't matter. If you have multiple neighbors and they are giving conflicting feedback, then you would weight their recommendations in terms of how close they are to you. Okay, yes. No, only if they rate.
But if
they don't rate, you ignore that user. It's not available. So you could say that, here is another way of thinking about it. Any item they didn't rate, you can imagine that they gave it their average rating. Right? Because that's what I'm assuming. If I don't know anything else, my rating for this item would have been my average rating. Right? So for them too, you could have assumed it's their average rating. Average minus their average will be 0. So it will contribute 0. So this would work only, in fact, the point you're making is this would work only if the neighbor you have actually rated the item on which I'm trying to, so the item for which I'm trying to decide my rating. You understand what I'm saying? This is not particularly surprising. Like, I really, really like, seem to have similar interests as Fred, okay? And I've decided I'll ask Fred whether or not to see Avatar. Now, Fred hasn't seen Avatar. What the heck is he going to tell me? Nothing. First, he has to go see Avatar before he can tell me whether he would like it or not. That's all I'm saying. So Fred may well be my, you know, closest buddy in terms of my taste, but if they haven't yet experienced that item, then they have nothing to tell me. No, but you would essentially throw it away anyway. So either you could say if the rating isn't there, that user won't take place in the summation. Or you could say that for anything that's not rated, its effective rating is the average rating of that user, in which case you take the user into consideration and this becomes zero anyway.
And in calculating average,
we
have to make
that. Yeah. Yes. So again, as I'm saying, either you can ignore one of the neighbors because that neighbor doesn't have a rating for the ith item, or you take them and assume their default rating is average, and you know, either way, essentially that part would be contributing zero to the numerator. Okay? The simplest case is to assume that, you know, that user just doesn't take part in this computation, because you only consider the users who do have the rating for the item under consideration, ith item. Okay. Now, this is very good. But one question that this does not capture is the following. Suppose I am a user U1, right, and I have rated items 1 to 1000. Okay? Then there is user W and the user G, W also has rated items 1 to 1000. They rated all these items. Okay? Except, you know, they tended not to be particularly similar to my rating. Okay? And then I have the item G, a user G who only rated 1 and 2. Okay? And so, and it turns out that if 1 is for me 2.35 and 2 is 4.37, they happen to just have 2.35, 4.37. Now, the correlation between U and G, remember, is being defined in terms of the items that they have rated together. Right? Right? So it looks as if G is the soulmate. Right? And then you are trying to see whether or not you would like 1007th item. According to W, 1007th item, you know, meh, it's like 3.5. Whereas according to G, 1007th item is a 10 out of 10. Whose recommendation should you take? Currently, the way we set it up, we are going to go with G's recommendation. But, you know, my way of, I mean, actually I have, so for those of you who have active imaginations, think of this as a user. This is the user's long-suffering spouse from whom they are getting estranged. And this is the user's current boyfriend, girlfriend, you know, who they are having an affair with, okay? Who basically they have much less common experience. The question is, do you go with the recommendation of your long-suffering spouse as to whether or not you would like avatar, or you would go with the recommendation of the person with whom you have just probably seen two movies? And probably they have to say they like them because you are in the throes of the first two date movies. Okay? So anyway, the point I'm trying to make is you need to take into account the length of the experience somehow. Okay, it's not enough to say I have a soulmate based on one day's experience. Although, as much as love at first sight is, you know, is the romanticized ideal, for collaborative filtering, that could be in, you know, some kind of a question. There's a question there. So, what do you do? How do you deal with this problem? One idea is to actually say that this weight is not just the Pearson correlation coefficient, but it's Pearson correlation coefficient weighted by the amount of common experience you have. Do you understand what I'm saying? So let's say Pearson correlation coefficient says you have 1.0, but then it's based on two items. Somehow that should mean less than a 0.7 that is based on 1,000 common items. That's what, you know, you would like to say. And so what you would do basically is that you change the weight to be essentially not just the Pearson correlation coefficient, but multiplied by this S measure, which is a similarity measure, which is one if in fact the common experience is larger than some number. Let's say that common items you rated together is, let's say, greater than 50. If you've seen more than 50 movies together, then presumably, you know, you have enough data to actually see whether or not these guys are soulmates. Okay? If it's less than 50, then, you know, I could say M over 50 is the scaling factor. Okay? This makes a big difference because you'll see that in collaborative filtering, the biggest issue is if you have a large enough item set for any two random users, the number of co-rated items can be very small. Number of co-rated items can be very small. Okay? And the real question is, can you just, based on the similarity or just a small set of co-rated items, can you assume that predicts future well enough, predicts other items well enough? If you don't, then essentially you do the scaling. Okay? So that's the, with that, you essentially have collaborative filtering. Okay? Now, let's look at, you know, in the next last 15 minutes, let's look at advantages and disadvantages of collaborative and content-based filtering in isolation and talk about how to combine them. Okay, so problems with collaborative filtering is cold start. There needs to be enough other users already in the system to find a match. Right, when Amazon started, there were no users. So how are they going to compare you to other users? Okay, and sparsity, if there are many items to be recommended, even if there are many users, the user rating matrix is too sparse. That means for any given two random users, the number of co-rated items may be too small. Number of co-rated items may be too small, and if you're using that data to decide how correlated they are, that could be a bad situation. Okay, first rater cannot recommend an item that hasn't yet been previously rated. This is sort of like how do you get page rank for pages that just got put on the web? And if once people know that this page exists, they might put a link to it so that its page rank increases. But if you only keep giving pages which have high page rank, then you'll never give the new pages. We talked about this, right? We talked about recency page rank, where you change the reset matrix such that the recent pages are given slight push. Remember that? So the same sort of an issue comes here too, because unless there are first raters, that for the new items will never be recommended, just based on collaborative filtering. Right? Okay? And then popularity bias. If enough people like certain thing, then you essentially think everybody should like it, irrespective of whether or not that actually falls in your interest. Okay? Collaborative filtering tends to recommend popular items just because, you know, enough people like them. Okay, so these are the problems with collaborative filtering. What about content-based filtering? Content-based filtering, in some sense, advantages are you don't need any data on other users. It's just dependent on you and your profile. Okay, and you are able to recommend to people with highly unique tastes. Okay, in fact, collaborative filtering sort of softens interest, right, to some extent, because there should be Joes that you have to keep up with. And if every Joe is a separate Joe, then there is no collaborative filtering. Okay, and you can also provide explanations. When you actually provide a recommendation using content-based filtering, you can provide an explanation as to why that was recommended. Amazon says, for example, click here if you want to know why we recommended. And when you click, they will try to say you bought these books and these had these words essentially, so you might be interested in this book. Now that if in fact they came to that recommendation using both collaborative and content-based methods, the justification is always in terms of content-based methods. Because what's the collaborative explanation going to be? It is to say users 95, 39, and 48 who turn out to be just like you just don't know them, like this thing. That doesn't give you the warm and fuzzy feeling required to, you know, one click buy, right? Okay. Now, of course, again, you know, it's a general classification technique too. So it's like you can provide basic classification. Any classification learning methods can be used for content-based learning. So content-based filtering. So after these two slides, it looks like content-based filtering is winning. Yes. What?
They all have this field saying people who like this item also like that system.
I understand, but the point is, what do I make out of that? It's possible that we will all eventually evolutionarily change. I mean, for the next generation, people who don't like Amazon would not have children. And so the people who will come into this world will assume that that's a great explanation. Hey, people like me seem to like it, so I should like it. I don't really need to know who these people are. I tend to think that I want to know who are these people, okay? And I think I'm not the only one in general, okay? So it is true, that's what they say, but it's not a very good explanation. There is no way, if there is an explanation, you should. So for example, you can ask, you know, this is because explanation. Remember the thing, I mean, for the kids, you know, you ask it, why are you doing this? They say, because. And that's an explanation, apparently. I didn't go to the kids' school, so I don't remember this as an explanation. And they think that's an explanation. The point is, the whole point of explanation is the person to whom the explanation is directed at should be able to independently check whether that explanation holds or not. How do I check whether because holds? How do I check whether what Amazon said holds. Whereas if they show, we made this because you did buy these books, then I can say, hey, look, I didn't buy this book. What do you mean I bought this book? So there is a way of falsifying the justification. Yes?
I think it's based on a trick in psychology with the bandwagon effect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you think other people are doing it, then you do it.
Yes, I agree. I mean, I think it's a...
People don't think about it, so they're just like, oh, really? Okay.
To the extent, so there are people who like explanations, in which case content-based has some advantage. The people who want to just be told what to do, in which case, you know, that any explanation is good enough. Okay? Now, let's look at the problems with content-based methods. It requires content that can be encoded as meaningful features. One of the things that you don't understand is that you can, based on the fact that you bought, let's say, 2 batteries for flip recorder, right? Amazon can say people who have bought 2 batteries for flip recorder also seem to be buying, let's say some, dark espresso roast. Okay? These are not, by any stretch of imagination, items in the same class. And yet, they, collaborative filtering allows you to essentially recommend to people items across other classes. Just because, the ones that you happen to have bought are enough similar that this new item which the other person bought, you would be interested in it. Even if you wouldn't have thought it would be in the, it would be in the same class in any sense. Okay? Basically, the advantage is content-based filtering requires an actual understanding of the item being recommended. Some description of the item in either features or some knowledge, some particular knowledge representation language, you need to describe that item. Collaborative filtering, you don't describe the item at all, you just describe other people's reactions to the item. Now one can say that really perception is reality. There is no thing to be said about that item. It only needs to be, what you need to say is what other people say about that item. In weird ways, actually, think about content-based versus collaborative filtering as anchor text versus text on the file. Anchor text is what other people are saying about this page. Text on the file is what that file really is about. Okay? You could say, I'll throw all the text on the file and I'll just go with the anchor text. That is a description enough of this file. That's more or less, similar to what collaborative filtering would be doing. So that's one thing. You need to actually find features to represent these items. User states must be represented as a learnable function of the content of features. Yeah, this is okay. The bigger issue is that you have to have these features and you have to have enough training data for each individual user. Okay, to be able to tell me whether I would like an electronics item, Amazon should have enough of a buying history of my buying history of electronics items from them. If I only have been buying books from them, they will only be able to recommend other books if they're just using content-based recommendation system. Okay? So they seem to be, whereas collaborative filtering can cross over all these domains and can say, since you like these books, maybe you want this camcorder. Or maybe you want some other garden equipment. Because people like you who bought these seem to be buying those. Right? So now here is an idea which is if they have sort of complementary advantages, can I combine them? Right? And one idea is, remember, the problem with collaborative filtering is sparsity of ratings. Suppose I have a user ratings vector for a particular user, and I'm trying to decide whether or not this user is actually close enough to me, the active user. Okay? Now, but the problem is only these bands, the green bands, are the items that actually have ratings. The rest of them, this user has not rated at all. Okay? Now, suppose I do the following crazy thing. I use content-based filtering on this user, so use these as the positive examples that the user bought, and then try to predict the ratings for the missing items that this user hasn't yet bought. Okay? So I use this to train a content-based predictor and apply it back to this user so that the user now has ratings for more items now. Okay? Now the more item ratings you have, the better collaborative filtering is going to be. Now, of course, you can also say the more fake ratings you have, the worse collaborative filtering is going to be. The question is, on one hand, this looks like a positive thing that I have now ratings for everything, but it also could be a negative thing because these ratings could actually be completely wrong. But they won't be wrong if, in fact, content-based filtering is doing its job right. Okay? So now, to the extent I hope this is working, then I would use this pseudo ratings vector. So this is the real user ratings vector. Based on this, I computed the pseudo user ratings vector, and then I will use that to train the collaborative filtering. Would that work? Would that be better? Turns out it actually is better. Okay, this is a good way of doing better than either collaborative filtering or content-based filtering. There are many other ways of combining them. This is one. Okay, there is a little paper in the readings list which describes this approach, for example. Okay, for the content-based predictor, they would wind up using this bag of vector of bags model. And for the collaborative filtering, they just use the model I just described. And they show that the recommendations they get with the combined method is better than the recommendations of either of the two methods. Okay? So user ratings matrix, you can get using the content-based predictor, you get a pseudo user rating matrix, and then use this pseudo user rating matrix to do the collaborative filtering, and this works better. Cute idea. Now, we can leave this. This is good news, and we could leave it alone, or we could, they say, look at the gift heart in the mouth and say, if I can do this kind of a nonsense thing, where I'm using content-based filtering to fill up the rest of the values of the user ratings, right? Why should I include the collaborative filtering? Why can't now I look at this as my training data, send it back to the content-based predictor to get an even better content-based filter? Do you understand what I'm just saying? So I had basically the ratings vector are the training examples. You only had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 training examples. Using these 5 training examples, you expanded, you generalized the ratings of those training examples to make learn a predictor which will tell you what would have been the ratings for all these guys. Okay, so now that's my pseudo rating vector, but that basically also means I have now increased the training data. Remember, I told you that one of the biggest problems in classification learning in web is labeled data. Labeled data is too small. There are many, many mails. A small fraction of them have been labeled to be spam or not spam. The rest of them have not been labeled. I did give you, so you have a friend who has been just given 15 mails, of which 7 are spam, 8 are not spam. You have been given those 15 mails plus a corpus of real extra 1,000 mails that some real user got. Would you say you have more training data than your friend? That's the question. Do you understand what I'm saying? It looks as if at the first blush, you guys have approximately the same data because the labeled data is the same. But your friend has these extra 1,000 real mails. Those were actually generated by people who really send mails. Now, what this friend can do is, you would be able to just learn spam, non-spam classifier using these 15, and you just start have to use it in the real world. Your friend can learn spam, non-spam, and the 15 mails, apply it to the rest of the 1,000 mails, see whether they are spam or non-spam. Now they have 1,015 training examples. Relearn the classifier. So you increase the training example. Okay? To the extent this idea works, Why won't that idea work? The answer is, and if it works, it's a great thing for you, right? Because you can get by with much less labeled data as long as you have unlabeled data. The difference between you and your friend is not the brains, that you both have approximately the same, let's hope, but your friend has extra unlabeled data which you thought amounted to nothing before. But if this thing works, then it means that that is giving you a leverage. Okay, so 2 points to make. This is basically this you know, closely spaced slide actually describes that idea that I just mentioned. Okay, and essentially it says it works. This idea works. So for example, here, let me go to your picture. So suppose I have the number of, so I have been, this guy is your friend who has been given 10,000 unlabeled documents in addition to the training data. And this x-axis tells you how much training data, labeled data, both of you have been given. Okay, and you can see that as the training data increases significantly above or close to 10,000, both you and your friend would be approximately the same in terms of training accuracy, testing accuracy. But for the low training data scenarios, your friend does much better. And all they had, they were using the exact same naive Bayes classifier. All they had, and that you don't have, is this 10,000 unlabeled documents, which you think, which you probably would have just run over them saying, I won't care. Nobody really cares about unlabeled documents. But that makes a big difference. Okay, now the reason this works, to make this idea work, about the only thing you do is actually rather than, remember, naive Bayes classifier would give predictions to each of the unrated data, right? But really what naive Bayes classifier computes is the posterior. And then we just used to pick the most likely class and say that is the class. The example, the algorithm that I showed you, essentially says keep the posterior prediction. So assume that for each example, you have fractional membership for that example in both class 1 and class 2. And you can generalize the naive Bayes classification very simply by just using weighted examples. So if I have a 0.8, if an example is 0.8 spam and 0.2 non-spam, then it contributes 0.8 to the spam computations and 0.2 to the non-spam computations. If an example is 1 spam and 0 non-spam, it just is like a pure example. And if you use these posteriors and then run the naive Bayes, and you keep doing this, you repeatedly do this until you don't change your predictions anymore on the test data. If you do that, that actually works. And the reason it works, you know, there are very interesting points that we can talk about, but this particular idea is called expectation maximization. It's a variant of expectation maximization. And intuitively, the reason why unlabeled data helps you is something that you have to think about. And you know, it's only 2 minutes and I'll say it, and you should think about this. Okay? Will unlabeled data help you all the time? For example, instead of giving your friend 10,000 unlabeled messages, okay, I generated 10,000 random documents. 10,000 random documents. A random document is just randomly take words from the corpus and say each document is a message and gave it to the friend. Would your friend still be able to improve their performance with these 10,000 random documents? Those are not real documents. In the sense, nobody actually generated them. First of all, you have to be able to convince yourself that if that also works, then there is something totally broken about the field of machine learning. Okay, that means you cannot even if you just randomly generate documents, somehow you are able to learn from them in trying to label them. The connection to this is essentially something that I mentioned a couple of classes back, which is people getting ready for an exam, do some example problems, and then they do some of the problems that are given at the end of the textbook. Those are unlabeled examples. But these are examples that are actually problems, which have well-defined solutions. Somebody spent time making those problems up. Okay, unless it's just a simple addition task, right? Generating problems are way more painful. You don't know this. I mean, unless you have set exam papers, you don't know how painful it is to set problems. You'd only consider the pain of actually answering the problems. Setting the problem requires that I know the answer, and I know that you would be able to do it in some reasonable amount of time, and then I give it to you. If I just randomly pick some number of words, think about the following idea for final exam. I'll pick some number of words from the notes, and a bag of words will be one problem. Second bag of words will be second problem, and you answer them. I don't know what answer means, that's a different story, but you get to answer them. Would that be working on those doesn't give you anything. So what you are getting as leverage here is something that we mentioned long back in the beginning of the semester, which is web is made by humans. The documents are not random documents. These are the documents that people generated. Okay? And so that gives you structure about what a well-formed email would look like. And first it has to be an email before you say it's a spam or a non-spam. First it has to be a human being before you say whether they're a terrorist or non-terrorist. Stick figures cannot be terrorists or non-terrorists. Okay? So that's the leverage you're getting. That's one of the, you know, very powerful ideas currently in machine learning, which is techniques that would be able to use unlabeled data. And in fact, sometimes unlabeled data doesn't work. I think there's a paper in the most recent NIPS which actually talks about, the title of the paper is sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work. The tale of unlabeled data. Okay? We'll stop there.